I'm Bob, an alcoholic. I have a friend who says when they speak in AA, they say, I'm here to comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. I'll tell you a little story before we're going to. I want to lighten this up because we're getting into a very heavy part of the program. Step 8 and 9. A few years ago, I went to an Alcoholics Anonymous convention in Mississippi. Now, I don't know if you realize this, but we have what we call the Bible Belt in alcohol in the U.S., right? And the town I was in is about where it buckles. And the nice people. I mean, really and truly nice people. And this couple picks me up at the airport, and they're taking me to the hotel where I'm going to be staying for the weekend. And they're what is known as they're Southern Baptists. Now, there's Baptists, there's Southern Baptists, and there's Southern Baptists. Now, the Southern Baptists can see the sins of the Southern Baptists and the regular Baptists. Right? These are Southern Baptists. So they take me to the hotel. We get to the hotel, and I'm checking in. They're standing there with me. Couple, nice couple. And they were very nice to me. And there's a sign on the hotel registration desk that says, adult X-rated movies available in the rooms. And I'm checking it out, and I know that this couple is looking at the sign with this angst. So there's a bit of me that's like a people pleaser kind of, you know, I want to score points with people, right? So I'm watching them looking at the sign, and I call the manager over. Excuse me, sir. He says, what's the trouble? I said, I want all of the pornography in my hotel room to be disabled. And he said, disabled? You sicko, we only have regular pornography in this hotel. Yep. Now we're approaching what terrified me the most. The only really thing that scared me, almost to the point of at times feeling so overwhelmed I wanted to bolt out of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 8th to 9th step. And it's odd because I understand intellectually the significance of it. It's just, it's too big. I could listen to you tell your stories about amends, and I thought, yeah, of course, if I was you, I could probably make the amends. But you don't understand. I live like an animal on the streets. I mean, I stole as a way of life. I mean, I just every single, there wasn't a day that went by that I didn't steal. It was all petty stuff. I was the kind of guy at the pub that I'd be drinking, and I'd run out of money, so when you went to the bathroom, I'd steal your change off the bar and drink your drink and move to a different part of the bar. And I'd get caught sometimes, and it was very embarrassing. I went down the street and your car was unlocked and there was something in there to steal, I would just take it. It's not personal. I need the medicine, right? I'm not work. I'm down and out, living on the streets, and it was a way of life. I can't tell you how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of packs of cigarettes I'd stolen. I supported my cigarette habit basically. I did this thing twice a day at minimum, where I'd walk into a gas station or a bar or a restaurant where they had a cigarette machine, and I'm unruly looking. I have hair down to about here that's kind of messed up and a long, unkept beard. I think I fancied myself a ZZ Top tryout or something. I don't know. I was not the kind of person you wanted in your establishment. And so I'd go up to the cigarette machine and I'd pretend to put change in the machine and then go crazy and bang on the machine, ripped me, until the manager would come out, open the machine up, and give me a pack of cigarettes to get rid of me. Now, I did that twice a day. Now, I get sober and I go to meetings and people are talking about amends. I remember one guy sitting in a meeting one time and a guy said, and you have to pay back all the money. And I remember sitting there going, are you kidding me? Oh, I started trying to do the math in my head. All the places I worked where I stole stuff, not even counting the money, the thousands and thousands of dollars that my parents and people at law, oh, I started doing the math and I thought, oh my God, if I got a good job, and I worked for 50 years and used all the money I made, I don't think I could pay it all back. It was overwhelming to me. And I almost bolted. And I often would sit in meetings and feel like I was the only one that was like that here. The only one that was overwhelmed because nobody else looked like they were struggling with this stuff like I was. And the fear was on me. And this has been a condition in Alcoholics Anonymous since the very beginning. In a sense, AA was actually founded on one man's eighth step. Mother's Day weekend, 1935, a guy who was sober 5 months went to Akron on a hope. He hadn't turned a tap, hadn't worked and made a dime for a long time. He was in trouble financially. And his wife, who'd been a debutante, came from a very wealthy, well-off family, was working in a department store for very, very little money, just trying to keep food on the table and keep the lights on. And he hadn't made any money, and he felt guilty. And he went there to Akron, and it was his big chance, this proxy fight, that if he went the way they'd hoped, that he was going to be set back on his feet financially. And the wheels came off. And it came off so bad that he ended up in this hotel lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, and I've stood in that hotel. I actually chaired a meeting in that hotel lobby not too long ago. It brought tears to my eyes as we read the part of the book where Bill's pacing in the lobby. And he's all alone. There's no sponsor. There's no one sober anywhere in the world. There's no one who believes what he believes except him. There's no book. There's nobody to call. There's no guidance here. There's nothing. There's just a belief that came from a spiritual awakening that he had in Towns Hospital. And it's... I want to get off on a little sidetrack. Most people think that the spiritual awakening that Bill had in the hospital was when he had his white light experience and the wind from a hall. He says, I don't think that's it. Let's see if I can read this. After Bill had the epiphany experience, the what was often touted as his spiritual experience in Town Hospital, something else happened to him that changed the world. A little minor thing he talks about in his story, and we are here as a result of it. See, people, the reason I believe this is that people, for alcoholics of our type, if you've ever read William James, have been having these kind of epiphany experiences for centuries, and drinking again. And something happened, and here Bill says, this is after his supposed spiritual experience. He said, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came from where? The thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what has been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. And an idea was implanted in Bill Wilson, an idea that would change the world. See, these epiphany experiences that alcoholics have, they're like hot coals. They're like embers. If you don't fan them by action, they never burst into flame. And Bill got into action the day he got out of Towns Hospital. Here's a guy, December 16th, 1934, a man checks out of the hospital and starts doing 12-step work. There's AA groups around the country won't let you do that. Oh, no, you got to be a year sober. Well, I'm sure glad they didn't tell Bill Wilson that. None of us would be here. And he believed, something woke up inside of him, and it was a desire, almost, in one time Bill referred to it as the magnificent obsession, the desire to help others. And here he is in this Akron hotel lobby, and the wheels have come off his life. And he's scared, and he's even thinking about drinking. He's watching and listening to the sounds flowing out of the cocktail lounge in that hotel lobby. And he's all alone, and there's laughter in there. There's none in him. And he remembered his commitment. And instead of going into the bar, he went to a phone. And he started calling people. And through a bizarre set of circumstances, when he was just almost out of change, he got to this Reverend Tunks, who knew of a woman named Henrietta Cyberling. And when he heard the Cyberling name, he kind of cringed a little bit, because the Cyberlings were heirs to this rubber tire corporation. They were the people that owned the big deal that he was there and just lost out on. Was from a company that was connected with the Cyberlings, and he had all the fear that maybe they know that what happened about the proxy fight. I don't know. And he, not the Cyberlings, but he called Henrietta, and Henrietta was amazed, because she had this friend who was a washed-up proctologist who had finally came out. Everybody else knew he was a drunk, but he thought nobody knew, and he finally came out and admitted to everybody he was a drunk, and they all prayed for him, and they prayed for help for Dr. Bob Smith, and all of a sudden Henrietta gets a telephone call, and a guy on the other end says, "I'm a rum hound from New York City, and I'm here because I need to talk to another alcoholic." And she thought, oh my God, oh my God. And she said, "Wow, I'll call you right back." And she calls the Smith residence, and her and Ann, Bill, Dr. Bob's wife, are very close friends. And she says, "Ann, our prayers have been answered. There's a guy from New York who's here who can help Bob. I know it. I know God sent him." And Ann said, "Well, that may be the case, but Bob can't see him right now. He's taking a nap under the dining room table." You got to love a guy like that, don't you? I mean, I do. I mean, I'm a napper, I'm a napper. I just drink and nap. Yeah. So they made arrangements for the next day. And Smitty, Dr. Bob's son, drove them there with Ann and Bob in the back, and Bob doesn't want to go. Oh my God. But he just ruined Mother's Day. I mean, he was drunk on Mother's Day. Oh, he came home with a potted, I love the way they say it. He says, Bob came home on Mother's Day with a potted plant, and he was potted as well. And and he was guilty. And when you're guilty, you'll buckle under and do stuff you don't do. Smitty, his son, stayed at my house for a week and just told us the story on several occasions, and how he drove his dad, and he could hear his dad in the back seat saying to Ann, "Please don't make me stay in there and listen to that Yankee talk about my drinking more. 15 minutes, that's all I can take. 15 minutes, please." And he meets Dr. Bob meets Bill Wilson, and they go into the library, not a very big room at the Cyberling Gatehouse, and it was hours later. Bob didn't want to come out. Bob had been talked to about his drinking. He'd been prayed over. Oh my God. He'd taken various pledges and swore to himself he'd never drink. But he went in there, and to his amazement, Bill Wilson never once mentioned Dr. Bob's drinking. Never talked about it at all. Bill Wilson had to unload the truth about Bill Wilson's drinking. And Dr. Bob sat there as some of us have sat in early AA meetings. And for the first time in your life, you're starting to make that connection. You're sitting there and you're nodding your head. And it's a refreshing, in the dank darkness of alcoholism, it is a refreshing light. And he came out with his arm around Bill. And he said to Ann, and he said to his son, Smitty, he said, this guy knows what he's talking about. And he said, Bill, why don't you come and stay at our house? And Bill didn't have enough money to pay his hotel bill, so I'm sure he said, well, you know, if you insist. And he went over and he stayed at Ardmore House the house on Ardmore Street for several months. And Dr. Bob, they sat there and they talked about spiritual principles and they talked about conversion. They talked about helping others and prayer and meditation. And Bill tried to interject this part about amends. And Bob would dug his heels in and he said, oh, geez, I can't do that, Bill. I'll do everything else. I'm not doing that. I've already damaged my reputation as a doctor in this community. Let's just let bygones be bygones, and I'll do everything else. And Bob wanted to go to a medical convention, an AMA convention in Atlantic City, and went, and he didn't even get there. He never did attend the convention. He got so drunk on the train, and he stayed drunk, that kind of drunk that I do, where you pass out, come to, drink, pass out, come to, drink, pass out, come, you know, and you do that for several days, and he's in and out of a blackout. He's almost comatose by the time he gets on the train to come back to Akron. When they get to Akron Station, they cannot wake him. He's so out of it. He's almost like an alcoholic coma, and I've been that guy where you can't even wake me up. I'm just so anesthetized by alcohol. The conductor didn't know what to do, so they just carried him and they set him on the platform, the Akron Station, and station master called his office secretary who came down there as she had come to rescue him on other occasions. And they eventually got him back to the house on Ardmore Street, put him to bed. He was a mess. He was a mess. And he came to very early in the morning on what at one time was believed to be June 10th. 1935. Now, historians are starting to think it might have actually been June 17th. But regardless, he came to sick, shaken, wanting to jump out of his skin as I come to after a long round-the-clock drunk for many days. Nerves are shot, full of remorse, self-loathing. And he says, what day is it? And they tell him, and he goes, oh, my God, no, it can't, no. I'm scheduled to do a surgery this morning, and his hands are shaking like this, and he's a mess. And Bill didn't know what to do. He said, you can't cancel. No, the guy, we have to do this surgery. It's important. It's urgent. So Bill takes him over to St. Thomas Hospital, and they we're not sure if it was St. Thomas Hospital. It might have been Akron City Hospital. They took him over to the hospital, wherever the surgery was to be. And Bill didn't know what to do, so Bill gave him a sedative and two bottles of beer just to try to calm his nerves enough that he could actually go in there and perform the surgery. Imagine being the patient. laying on the gurney. Here comes your surgeon, reeking of beer with his hands shaking. Oh, my God. We should build a statue of that guy somewhere. I mean, you know, jeez. We don't know what happened to the patient. I know two historians that went and searched the records at Akron City Hospital and St. Thomas Hospital trying to find more information about this guy so they could track him down and or try to find out what happened to him. All it says in the book is that he lived. But no, and we don't know if he whistled when he walked or not. We don't know. And Dr. Bob was a proctologist, so you can just imagine all kinds of possibility. But the guy lived. And Dr. Bob had finished. It was a quick surgery, evidently, just a little cancer surgery they had to remove. And he got out of that surgery. He was done early in the morning, still in the morning. And he disappeared. And Bill and his wife, Ann, assumed that he went on a drunk, as I would have assumed. I mean, he had to give the guy a beer to steady his nerves. And he never came back that morning or that afternoon. His son told us that it was probably, he thought it might have been close to midnight when his dad came home. And he walked into the house, and he hadn't been drinking as everyone had feared. And he looked different. Something had happened to him. And they discovered that he'd been out searching out every person he was afraid to face. And one man finally became willing to go to any lengths. You know, there's a, when it says any lengths, that's what they're referring to. It's twice talked about in the section on step 8 and 9. It's been misinterpreted over the years. And you go to some meetings, discussion meetings, you bring up the subject of willing to go to any lengths, you'll get a different view of it today. It's out of treatment centers now, it starts to look like, well, it means to try not to drink and go to meetings. It was originally meant, are you willing to really, really do this? Are you willing to go out and face all the people, pay the money back? Are you willing to do all of that? I think, you know, Father Ed Dowling says that he thinks step 6 separates the men from the boys. And I understand what he's talking about, but I think this one does really. This is where we get to see, are you really willing to go? Or is it just fantasy? Are you willing to really push yourself aside to serve a way of life and a set of principles greater than you? Tough, tough stuff. Tough stuff. Dr. Bob did. He never took another drink again the rest of his natural life. He lived another 15 years. In those 15 years, Alcoholics Anonymous was cemented in place. In those 15 years, the estimates are that Dr. Bob personally helped over 5,000 alcoholics, who helped alcoholics, and instilled in them the ethic of helping alcoholics. And I would dare to say that in some form or other, we are all here indirectly as a result of Dr. Bob Smith in one way or another, as a result of one man's finally willing to walk through the fear. And that was pretty much the situation I was in 1978. And I had fell into the hands of people who, they weren't big book technicians by any means, but they were very big on amends, and they were very big on service. And the prayer, going to meetings, service, and pay the money back, face the people you don't want to face. And they started encouraging me to do this stuff. And it was, I didn't want to do it. I was afraid. But I did it. And it's okay to be afraid. It's even okay not to want to do it as long as you do it. It doesn't matter as long as you do it. There was a man who died a few years ago, Frank Honeycutt. And Frank was such an amazing member of AA. He said something that I've carried all ever since. He said that Alcoholics Anonymous is not for those who need it. And we all kind of get that. I mean, I bet you everybody in this room knows someone who's drinking themselves to death who needs AA, but they're not here. And Frank said something that was even more interesting. He said it's not even for those who want it. And I've thought about that over the years, and I've watched it. That's really true. If you were to come and visit me in Las Vegas, I go to a detox down on Skid Row twice a week. And this is the place you'll see the people who had the nice houses at one time, and now they're living on Skid Row. This is the place where the people with the 10 years sober that drink again end up. And outside the detox, there's this old oak tree. It's about maybe 4 feet in diameter. It's a big old tree, and it used to have these big rocks around the base of it that somebody put to make, and they were painted white, and it kind of looked nice to have rocks around the base of the tree. And men and women would sit and lay against that tree because the detox is full and there's no beds. And they would lay there and have seizures and go into convulsions and die. And there's been several people who have died. I eventually started calling it the dying tree. And when I go to the meetings in the detox and I see someone sitting against the tree, and now they've taken the rocks out of there because there was a guy who actually went into a convulsion and split his skull up open on the rocks and died. I'll go and I'll talk to these men and women sometimes, and they're very pathetic, and they're shaking and they're coming apart at the seams. And I've seen men and women sobbing tears of sincerity tell me how much they want this, and they never get sober. Because Frank said it's not for those who need it, and it's not for those who want it, it's only for those who do it. And they don't do it. And we're big at that. I'm big at... It's the line in the book that says, if you want what we have. Now, if it stopped there, it'd be great. Because, I'll take two. Yes. But it could, and then it follows it up and says, and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. Well, let's not overcorrect. I mean, and they're a package. You can't have what we have unless you do what we do. And you can sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with untreated alcoholism for decades until you eventually drink again or get so depressed you have to go to a doctor, or as some people do, commit suicide. And it's tragic. And the only difference between those of us that survive ourselves here and that eventually get free and have some reasonable comfort and happiness, not perfect, but reasonable, I mean, get really a pretty good life, is not what we feel or not what we think or not what we, it's only what we do. It's only the actions that I take. And I am so grateful that it's designed that way, because one of my great fears is that I had to become good to get this. And I'm too stained to get it if that's the case. All I had to do was do what you do. They started walking me through the fears of some amends. When I was brand new, I hadn't even done a fourth step yet, and they got me making amends. They had me turn myself into the courts back east, and it was a horrifying thing. We talked about that yesterday. And I tell you, when you join a home group and you get a sponsor, it's like you're opening the door. You're giving people in AA spiritual consent to butt into your business. Now, you don't even know you're doing it, but let me tell you, they butt into your business. They start asking you questions, uncomfortable questions. Like, so, where are your mother and father? Oh, they're back east. Oh, have you talked to them lately? We don't talk at all. Oh, so you haven't made amends to them yet. It's not like that. It's just, I've done a lot of stuff to them and they won't have anything to do with me. And it's just the way it is. Oh, so I think you should start making amends to your parents. You don't understand. It's too late for that. Maybe a couple years ago, before I sold the silver that was my mother, the only thing she had left of her mother, before I pawned that, maybe before I smashed the chair over the kitchen counter, swinging at my dad's head because he confronted me about something. And I put that terror in him where he wasn't even comfortable around he was scared of his own son. Maybe before I'd embarrassed him as much as I did, maybe then I could have made amends, but it's too late now. They've made it very clear that they're not going to take my phone calls. I'm not welcome in their house. They don't want to have anything to do with me. And the people in AA, it's like they nod their head and smile and listen, and they didn't hear a word you said. They didn't hear any. He said, well, that's nice. Well, here's what we want you to do. I just told you there's nothing to do. He said, no, we want you to start calling your mother every week. You don't understand. They won't take the calls. And you know what this guy said to me? It blew my mind. He said, don't call collect. That never would, I would have never occurred to me. I always called my mother collect and they'd always hang up. No, and I'm taking the charges. I'd call them from jail. You know, collect, reverse the charges. They'd hang up. I remember the first time I ever called my mother, and I pay in for the call. She answers the phone, and the minute she hears my voice, you can hear the disdain and the fear and the adamancy. Just, what do you want? And then she, there's a panic that creeps into her voice, and she goes, oh, you're not back in Pennsylvania again, are you? I said, no, Mom, I'm in Nevada. Well, you're in Nevada? Well, the operator didn't ask me to pay for the call. I said, no, Mom, I paid for the call. Her voice, like, broke and shot up an octave. She went, you paid for the call? Like, she couldn't believe it. Isn't that funny? Self-centered people like me, those kind of things never occurred. Little simple things in life never occurred to me. Too self-centered. And she did not, it was not a homecoming. She was very wanting to get off the phone really quickly. And people in AA said, call her every week. Started calling her every week. They said, I want you to send her little notes, little cards and stuff in the mail. And they were very adamant about this. You must never miss one of their birthdays, their anniversaries, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Christmas. You got to send them a little gift. Well, I don't have any money. If you can afford cigarettes, you can afford a gift for your mother and your father. I remember the first Christmas. I'm working minimum wage. It was pathetic. I didn't know what to get him. I got my dad a necktie. I think it was like $6 or $8. Some cheap little necktie. Nothing necktie. It was pathetic. I don't want to send this to him. My God, I'm so far behind with my father. If I bought him a brand new Bentley, it wouldn't scratch the surface of how far behind I am with my dad. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this pathetic little necktie. People in AA, they don't listen to you. They just they're one way, just, wow, good, that's, he'll like that. And I was like, all right. I sent it to my dad, and it lit him up for a moment. And then the wall came back down. Of course it did. I used to get my feelings hurt because they're not opening their arms to me. Listen to me. With what I put my parents through for all those years, if they would have welcomed me back into their life, there would have been something wrong with their mental health. I mean, they shouldn't have welcomed me back. I broke their hearts over and over and over. I mean, we're not talking once or twice. We're talking years of this. To the point where they physically cut me out of their life, and I found out through my sister that I guess they couldn't completely cut me out of their heart because my mother had to see a therapist and take medication. And my father slept 15 hours a day. And I did that to them. They became recluses, hostages in their own home as a result of me. They had once had a tremendous social life. They had a lot of friends, and they would have go to parties and all kinds. And the last several years, they just stayed home because they just were worn out answering the questions about me. Because everybody'd ask, I hear Rob's in jail. I hear he's in another treatment. They just got tired of it. And so they became hostages to my bad behavior. And they became recluses, and they lived a lonely, depressing life. And I was the catalyst of all of that. And I don't think there's an amends that could be made to them. And people in AA kept persisting. And after, it took a year of weekly actions and sending them gifts and cards and the telephone calls, a year, and they're still kind of holding me at arm's length. But when I was about a year sober, they decided to come out to Las Vegas and eyeball me, because they think I'm conning them. They're very skeptical about what I'm telling them on the phone and in the cards and stuff. But they came out not for a family reunion. They came out with this attitude, well, we'll go and see. But he's probably still a bum who's trying to hustle us, trying to get back into the will, trying to whatever. But, you know, even if he is a bum still, we've never been to Las Vegas. It will not be a complete loss. And they flew out to Las Vegas, and I met him at the airport. I took him out to dinner with my sponsor and his wife. His wife had passed away many years ago, wonderful woman. And my sponsor said, he made a great suggestion. He said, why don't you invite him to your home group? And my home group was an amazing group. It was It met in people's homes. And there were some members of the group that were very successful. So they had these huge houses, and there'd be like 60 people in a living room, you know? And they had people would come an hour before the meeting started. They'd socialize. There was a lot of camaraderie. And they had birthday cakes. Every week they had a cake. And it was great. And in my home group, I got to take my parents there, and they got to watch me and see me with you. And, you know, so my sponsor knew this. I didn't know this, that I've never, ever been better than I am when I'm with you. They saw the results of Alcoholics Anonymous in the interaction in my home group. Because it was like one of those kind of groups where there was a bunch of old-timers, and they laughed a lot, and they picked on the newer people. I don't know if it is that way in AA where you come from, but it's like, oh, you know, the newer person's having problems. Oh, and they just think it's funnier than hell. Oh, they just think, oh, lost your job, didn't you? Oh, this is going to be good. You're going to help people with that one. Gambled away your paycheck. Oh, getting this surrender, just beautiful. I mean, just, you know, they'd say crazy things to And then they got to see me. I ran with a pack of guys that were all sober within about 6 months of each other. And we did a lot of service together. We seemed like this pack of guys, and all of them stayed sober. All the ones that continued to do it stayed sober. And we'd go to two meetings a day. We'd go to the detox. We'd go looking for newcomers. I mean, we were like Nazi 12 steppers. I mean, we'd go, you know, we're going to drag people into our home group, you know, that didn't want to be there. But they got to see me running with the guys I ran. And then there were some new guys there. There was actually a guy there that I was trying to sponsor. And I was picking on him and making fun of him, because AA functions on the first rule of plumbing, that crap runs downhill, right? I remember watching my mother and father in the meeting and watching them laugh. It's stuff that we were laughing at. Certain things that they didn't get. There were certain... We have a bizarre kind of humor in AA where we laugh at stuff that some normal people go. You peed on the Christmas tree and you think that's funny? But we think stuff like that's funny, right? But so some of the humor they didn't get, but they got some of it. And I remember watching my mother. There was someone in the meeting that was very emotionally moved because they'd just gotten their kids back. And I remember my mother leaned over to my dad, grabbed his hand and said, "This is really good." And I don't know that they ever understood AA, but they felt something here. Before they left to go back to Pennsylvania, I was instructed to make my list of all the money and stuff I owed my dad. And oh, it was overwhelming. I was supposed to come up with a payment plan and present it to him to see if he'd accept it. And it was going to be 12 and a half years of payments to make this right. When you're a year sober, 12 and a half years is a lifetime. It was unbelievable. And I went to do it. I wanted to pay him back, but I kind of wanted to do it by like hitting the lottery or something. You know what I mean? Then I could be the big grand. I'd come in on a limo and give him a check or something. You know, but the people in AA said, "You sold your integrity a nickel and a dime at a time, and you'll buy it back a nickel and a dime at a time. You'll make the payments. You'll get more from the payment than the grandiose gesture." And I sat down with my parents in the coffee shop of the hotel they were staying at, Stardust, and presented my plan to them about the 12 and a half years of payments, and asked my dad if there's other stuff that I don't know about, I can't remember, tell me. And my dad looked at me and said to me, he said, "Robbie, we don't want you to pay back the money. We are delighted that you seem to be on the right track. This is the first time in years that we really had any hope that maybe you were going to be okay. We just want you to keep doing this thing you're doing and just stay sober. And if you do that, forget about the money." Oh, man, I remember. I couldn't believe it. I just, I just hit the recovery lottery. I mean, I just got out of 12 and a half years of payments. That's like a free house or something. I mean, it was amazing to me. And I was so excited. I was on my way. I left the Stardust, and I was on my way to my sponsor's office to tell him the good news. Man, I don't have to pay. This is amazing. And on the way over there, I'm thinking about other people I owe money to. I wonder if I could get them to see the light like my dad did. And I walk into his office, and I'm on this pink cloud. This is amazing. And I told him. My dad said I don't have to pay him. And you know what he says to me? He says, it doesn't matter what your dad said. That's your debt. You got to make that right. You know, there are just times you know you got the wrong sponsor. I mean, it's just... I said, what are you talking... I said, you don't understand. He won't take the payments. How am I going to pay him? And you know what he said? He says this to this day. He's an old guy. I'm going to take him to the Hawaii conference in November. He's a dear man. He says, he's been saying this since I've been sober. He says, I don't know, but a way will be shown.
I don't know, but a way will be shown.
What the hell does that mean? I don't know, you know? A way will be shown. What way? I mean, if I send my dad a little check, he ain't even going to cash it. You know, what are you talking about? And he was right. Now, I'm working as running a cash register for not much more than minimum wage in a retail store. And it's the late 1970s. My dad had a hobby. My dad used to collect all the United States, all the coins were made of solid silver up until 1964. And then from 64 to 69, they were made partially silver, certain coins. And then they cut it off. There was no silver. There's been no silver in a U.S. coin since. And my dad collected those. And he also collected the old war nickels that were partially silver. And he collected the silver certificates and the gold certificates. And in 1978, 1979, there was a lot of that stuff still in circulation. And I'm running a cash register. It comes through the register every day. Every day. And I thought, oh, this would be very cool. Maybe I'll talk to my boss and I'll see if I can buy this stuff out of the register and I'll put it aside thinking that, you know, one day I would have a nice little gift from my father. This would be very cool. The thought never crossed my mind that I was going to pay the debt with this. That would be ludicrous. And I talked to my boss and he said, sure. And there's something that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the essence of God's grace. And it's a principle that Carl Jung first coined. It's called synchronicity. And what synchronicity is a picture of a universe that is the most loving and accommodating universe you could ever imagine. That from the moment of commitment to doing the right thing, even though it may be impossible, the universe will start shifting subtly and incrementally to make the impossible an eventuality. And we see that time and time and time again in Alcoholics Anonymous. Look at all the times you'll sit. If you sit in meetings, you go to meetings for a couple of years, you'll see evidence of this time and again. You'll see people who have had their kids taken away from them, and they'll never see their kids, and all of a sudden they got their kids. You'll see people who have been in the mental health system for so long and on meds for so long that there's no light anymore in them. And you'll see them, they're all of a sudden free of everything, 2 years sober, and they're laughing, they're sponsoring guys, and they're making fun of people, and they're having a good time. I mean, how does that happen? The best efforts of psychiatry and medicine couldn't help that guy. How does that happen? It'd take a freaking miracle. And yet it happens. And the universe started massaging life itself to accommodate my efforts to do the right thing. It wouldn't do it to gratify myself or do for me, but to do for others, you bet. And I found myself in no time at all. I'm starting to have bags of silver quarters and half dollars and silver dollars and dimes and war nickels. And I had a shoebox that filled up with some $100 gold certificates. I had some of those. My boss had to hold them for me for a month till I could get the money to buy them. And I started getting raises and bonuses, and I started making more and more money. And there was a guy in AA who was a friend of mine who had a moving truck, and he would and we were good friends. He would schedule his moving furniture around my times off or when I wasn't working, and he'd give me so I could make an extra $100 a couple times a week helping him move furniture. And it was amazing. At a little over four years, I'd accumulated at face value the total 12.5-year debt. That shouldn't have happened. But God accelerated the process. It's almost, I've watched this 1,000 times in people. When you start self-sacrificing and paying people back, it's like you get lucky. It's like you become a magnet for good stuff. It's just an unavoidable cause and effect. Does that mean you're going to get rich? Not necessarily. Does it mean that everything you need is going to happen? I believe so. Isn't that the covenant in step 3 in the third step promises? It says having a new employer, God, being all powerful, he'll provide what you need if you can do 2 things. Keep close to him and perform his work well. The power won't be there for you to be self-serving, but when you're trying to do the right thing, the power shows up. It's amazing. And I, at a little over 4 years sober, I went with the woman I was dating at the time, who was eventually be the mother of my daughter, and we drove back to Pennsylvania with a back seat full of boxes and bags of coins and stuff, and I gave it to my dad. And now, I want you to know that when I gave that to my father, I had made a lot of amends to him verbally, and we were pretty good. I mean, he'd forgiven me. I mean, I knew he loved me. There's no doubt. I mean, you know, we started to have a kind of pretty good relationship. He knew that I loved him, and it was pretty good. But there was still something missing, and to this day, I don't know how much of this was in him and how much of it was in me. But there was still a little bit of something between us that I couldn't put my finger on. And it appeared to me in my perception, and I'm suspect of my perception, but here's what it looked like to me. It looked like he loved me, but I'm Bob. You know Bob. Our daughter went to a great university. Bob's in a 12-step program. I'm like special bus Bob. You know what I mean? Now he never said that, but I always felt like he loved me, but it wasn't really like a respect thing. You know what I mean? You got to make allowances for Bob. You know, that kind of thing. That's the way it felt to me. And when I gave him that money, it blew his mind. He never expected it. And I think that was the day I became a man in my father's eyes. And the whole relationship shifted. And I don't know how much of that was within me and how much of it that was within him. I don't know. But I tell you, in my experience, it changed. And it became very sweet. And we became very close. And I'm sad to tell you that I only had another year after that with my father, and he died. And I was able to fly back to Pennsylvania and bury him. And we were even. There were no ghosts. See, I know about ghosts. I know about what happened after I got sober, the ghosts of the things I did to my grandfather who had already died before I got sober. You know, the things that haunt you, the little emptinesses that haunt you, the thoughts that I wish I would have never done that, or I wish I would have told him how sorry I was, or I wish I would have made that right, or I wish I would have, I never even thanked him for the things he did for me as a kid. I don't even know that I ever told him I loved him. I know about those ghosts. And oddly enough, there's a thing in the book where it talks about how to deal with the people that have died. It says some people can't be seen. So we write them an honest letter. And I've gone to the grave sites I've gone to my family's grave sites. First I wrote the letter and took it in the desert. And then later, years later, I went to the grave sites of my family members and had that talk, cried those tears. I've taken people that I sponsor. I've sat with them in graveyards as they made amends to children that had died because of their neglect. Parents that they had been at odds with, brothers and sisters that had passed, husbands and wives. And the spirit of my father is very much alive within me, and it's sweet. There have been times in my sobriety where I felt his presence. I know that sounds kind of voodoo-y, but I tell you, I felt it. When my daughter was born, in the delivery room, I felt him in there. When I sold, 10 years ago, I got tired of my business and I sold it. And when I got the first seven-figure check, I swear I could hear his voice say, "Rob, you done good." And that is something I will carry to my grave, a joy and a gratitude towards Alcoholics Anonymous for what you've given me and how you led me back to what, to really to the restoration that I've always yearned for. See, all the years I was estranged from my parents, it hurt me. It broke my heart. Because, you know, some people had terrible parents that were alcoholic and they were abused and stuff. And I understand that, but I could never hang that on them. I always knew that they were good people and they loved me. I tried to blame them for stuff. I tried to pick them apart. You know how we do. You know, you look for the stare at them until you find the faults. But the truth was, I always knew that they were really good people and they loved me. And it broke my heart to be that estranged from them. I'll tell you about one more amends. I think the hardest amends we ever have to make are for things we do in our sobriety. You know, for the stuff you do when you're drinking, you can kind of, there's an unconscious self-exoneration where you kind of tell yourself, "Well, I was drunk, I wasn't sober. I mean, you know, I was messed up. Hey, I was messed up, you know." But what, you can't say that when you do stuff sober. It's selfish. Dishonest. When you become a liar, a cheat, and a thief sober, well, it's hard. And I was working, as I said earlier, I was working as a cashier in a retail store, and I had a horrid a tobacco addiction back in those days. I would smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day. I was the guy I'd light a cigarette off a cigarette often. I mean, I smoked a lot. And back in those days, you could smoke everywhere. Oh, I remember being in AA meetings. By the end of the meeting, you couldn't even see the people in the back of the room. I mean, I mean, about once a year, they'd have to repaint the walls white because they would become yellow and brown. I mean, that's how bad. Well, you get 100 people in a room like this, and they just try crazy things like, say, "Now, would you please cut down on your cigarettes smoking in the room? It's too heavy." The minute they'd say that, everyone in the room would light one up. It was like, "Oh, I better get one in," you know? And I had a terrible cigarette habit. And I went to work one day. It was a Thursday, and I'm broke. You know, I live paycheck to paycheck many weeks. And I don't get paid till Friday. And I'm out of cigarettes. I ran out of cigarettes. Well, one of the things we sold in the store was cigarettes. So I thought to myself, and that's usually the way I do it. I thought to myself, "Well, I'll take a pack of those cigarettes. And then tomorrow when I get my paycheck, I'll cash the check out of the bank like we usually do. And I'll ring it up. It's reasonable. I'm not stealing anything. I'm just deferring the paying for it till tomorrow. That's all." And I took that pack of cigarettes. I smoked it. I went home that night, came to work the next morning, and cashed my paycheck. And part of me, the good part of me, says, "Bobby, you bring that up." And there was immediately another voice. This is the voice of my enemy. But it's a seductive voice, isn't it? And it starts saying things to me like, "You know, you come to work early and you stay late, Bob." You work harder than everybody else here. It's only a pack of cigarettes, for God's sakes. Don't be stupid. It's just a... I mean, everybody does some of this. It's, hey, it's probably factored into the cost of operation. And I never rang the cigarettes up. And I opened a door that I could not close. And I started supporting my three-pack-a-day habit by stealing cigarettes from where I worked. And my ability to sweep things under the rug is amazing. I'm doing this for months and months, and stealing occasionally a six-pack of Diet Coke, and I'm doing it daily and turning a blind eye to it. You know, nothing wrong here. But in the realm of the spirit, there's a bizarre cause and effect that happens to us. You do some stuff over here that's selfish and dishonest, and the results don't immediately break out over there sometimes. Sometimes they break out over there and over there and over there. And I started having problems in different areas of my life that I don't connect to this fact I'm stealing every day. One of the things that started happening to me is I don't want to go to meetings anymore. This is so bizarre. It appeared to me now that I go to meetings, everybody that's sharing is a hypocrite. They're phony. You know, they talk about they're not really like it. And I found out later in hindsight that I was projecting my own belief and my own phoniness onto you. Because I'm going to meetings with a facade, living the double life as if I'm this honest, upright member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I was in a relationship. I started to tear her apart. And eventually it came full circle back to, I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous, one judgment at a time. And my spirit's getting sick. One of the things we sold in the store that I worked in was alcohol. And what had happened to me was exactly what it talks about in the book. I had been placed in a position of neutrality. Selling cases of beer and bottles of wine, it's like selling shoes. It had no pull at me. But now after I'm stealing for a while, they're starting to become interesting. I remember a guy came in one time, some wacko guy who's stoned. He comes in and he says, "You got it in, didn't you?" I said, "What's that?" He said, "Jägermeister." I don't even know what Jägermeister is. He says, "Oh, give me a bottle of that." I said, "Oh, what's this?" He said, "Oh my God, it's like alcohol and cocaine and opium all put together. This stuff is amazing." And I went, "Really?" And I went home thinking about Jägermeister. I had been working in that place for a long time, and it never did that to me. But my spirit's starting to get sick again. And now it's starting to look like medicine. It's starting to look like relief to me. Right? Because I'm sick in here. But I don't know I'm sick. And that's the frightening part, is I can get that sick and not know I'm sick. I'm on my way to another drink. And I don't even know it. And I got, after months of this, I'm getting wackier and wackier, and I'm on my way out, and I'm scared. And I get down on my knees one night in this little apartment, and I'm doing this rote routine that means nothing, because you say the same prayer over and over again every day, it means nothing after a while. And the route is thank you for my day of sobriety, and then I go to bed. And I'm on my knees saying thank you for the day, and I just yelled out, I said, "God, what the hell's going on here?" And the minute I asked the question, deep down in my innermost self, I knew what was going on. It was like the veil lifted, and all of a sudden I'm looking at myself stealing those cigarettes every day. And I knew. I didn't want to know. I didn't, because I know what I got to do, and I started figuring it out. And you think of three packs of cigarettes a day is not that much. You do that for the good part of a year, it's horrendous. And I don't have the money to make it right. And I know what I got to do. I got to go to my boss, who is going to fire me instantaneously. I know it. I've watched him. He has zero tolerance for employee theft. I watched him physically throw a guy out one time who he caught stealing. Now I'm going to have to go get another. If I had the money, then I could say, I'm sorry, here's the money, and maybe he wouldn't fire me. I don't have the money. He's going to fire me. I'm going to have to go get another job, and then I'm going to have to make payments to him. And how am I going to get another job? I don't have a good resume to begin with. This is another blanks, unexplained section. Most alcoholics who get sober, what'd you do for those 3 years? Oh, self-employed. I sold blood and dealt drugs and stole is what I really did. I'm just humiliated. It was one of those places that all great spiritual growth comes from. One of those places where you can't stand yourself. You know what I mean? I couldn't stand it. And you know, here's the hardest part. The guy I have to go and talk to has heard me on a couple occasions prattle on about my rigorous program of honesty. Oh, God, I want to shoot myself. I'll tell you something, what I learned from that, I try not to misrepresent myself. And I don't trust anybody who tells me how honest they are. Most of the really sincerely honest people I know will tell you the truth about themselves, that if you scare them, if they get financially insecure enough, they're capable of stealing. They may have to come back and make amends, but they don't delude themselves that they've risen above these things. And I tried to represent myself. Isn't it funny? From the moment I started stealing, I started to talk about my honesty more and more. Right? And I went to this man who I knew was going to fire me, and I started telling him. And he got pissed at me. He started yelling at me. I really hurt him because he'd been very nice to me. He had given me a break. He gave me a job when nobody else would give me a job. I mean, he had been very good to me. He treated me very well. And then when he was done yelling at me, I'm sitting there and he says, you better pay back every dime of it. And I came out of a fog. I said, I still have the job? He said, yeah, you still have the job, but you better not steal anymore. And never again. And pay back every dime of it. And I sat down and I figured out the amount. And here's what I did. Some of you think this is silly, but I tell you, it worked for me. I sat down and I figured on paper, the best of my ability, how much it was. And then I added on another 10% and then added on another $50. And I'll tell you why. Because if I'm going to estimate how much I owe this guy and I misjudge it, it's probably not going to be misjudged in his favor. You know what I mean? Because I know how I am. I remember in the old days, we'd all chip our money and get and buy a pound of pot. I'll divide. You know why I'm going to divide, because I'll get, and this is yours. So I know that, and besides, there was a part of me that I would rather risk overpaying it a little bit and be free than stand any possibility that I might have been just below the amount. I've worked with a lot of guys over the years, and they'll tell me things. Well, I don't know how much I stole. You know what I say to them? Yes, you do. No, I really don't. Oh, no, I'll tell you exactly how you can figure it out. Well, what I say, just give me a ballpark. Well, somewhere between $3,000 and $7,000. Okay, here's how we'll find out. Is it $7,000? Oh, no, it's not $7,000. Is it $6,500? No, it's not $6,500. Is it $6,000? No, I don't think it's $6,000. Is it $5,500? Well, okay, we're going to go back up to six. Pay him six. Because the ego will balk when you're starting to think it's right, it's probably a little bit less, right? And I... I made those payments to this guy, and then I'll tell you what happened. Sometimes I don't see this stuff until hindsight. What happens in my life is amazing. I pay this guy back within 30 days of paying the last payment. I'm very happy working there now. I mean, I remember thinking, I think I'd like to work here the rest of my life. This is, I like the people, I like the boss, I like the other employees. I really liked it. I felt like this is my place to work. A guy came to me. I was not looking for a job. He came to me out of nowhere and offered me a job that was basically had a chance of making about twice as much money, plus a chance for advancement from then. And I thought, oh, my God, that's amazing. I went to my boss, and he said, hey, you need to take that. I can't help you. I can't give you that much yet. This is good for you. Take it. And I gave him the notice, and I went to work at this other guy, and I never took a ballpoint pen out of that place. I never stole nothing from him. And I gave him 10 cents every day for his nickel because my grand sponsor had taught me how to go to work. He said, you go to work for one reason and one reason only, and that's to help God's kids. You forget about yourself and you go there to be of service. And I started doing that, and I started running that place, which facilitated more and more raises and bonuses, which chipping away at all my other amends at the same time. And I'm in a restaurant, a Denny's restaurant one night, and my ex-boss who I'd robbed, stolen from, and paid back was sitting in there with his wife. And I went up and started talking to him. How you doing? He said, I'm a little down. I said, really? What happened? He said, did you hear I was trying to sell my store? I said, I did hear that. How's that going? He said, it fell apart. The wheels came off. I was selling it to this guy from Korea, and because we have slot machines in the stores and a liquor license as part of the deal, he had to go for this intensive investigation that you have to go for the gaming control board and the liquor control board people, and he said the guy couldn't pass. There was too much stuff in his past that they couldn't clear up. And so it fell apart. The guy ran the business into the ground. He ran it for 6 months, and they took away his conditional license, and they refused him the permanent license, and I got it back in my lap. And he said, I'm a little down. He said, I thought I was going to retire. I was burnt out. And I guess it's not in the cards. And I stood there, and I had an out-of-body experience. As I heard myself say words to him, as I listened to myself say them, I was embarrassed. I heard myself say to him, oh, man, would I like to buy your store. And the minute I said it, I was embarrassed because I don't have any money. I said, oh, but, I don't have any money. Just kidding. Just a thought, I was embarrassed. And he sat there for a minute, and then he said to me, he said, what's your day off? And I told him, he said, maybe down here we'll have lunch. And I walked into that Denny's. He was sitting in a booth. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And he had a folder with some papers sitting there. And I sat down, and he started to make me an offer. He said, if you'll come back and you'll run this business for me, if you can get the numbers up, you got to get it. You're going to have to work hard because it's doing very poorly. You're going to have to get it back into the profitable range like it was at one time. But if you can do that, out of that profit, you'll gain a piece of the business every year. And at the end of 5 years, it's yours. And you'll still have to pay me some payments for a while out of the business on inventory and fixtures, but it'll be yours. And I couldn't believe what he was saying to me. I'm a guy with no education. I got a resume that's pathetic. I get, I'm a cashier. I sell blood. I did telemarketing. I mean, I am not a rocket to stardom here. And I said, oh, my God, I'd love to do that. And I gave my notice, and I came to work there, and I did what Chuck Chamberlain told me to do, and I rolled up my sleeves and went to work. And it was hard. I worked probably 16 hours a day for a while. And the business started to grow. When I took that store over, it was grossing about $600,000 a year. Right before, there was a little time before I sold it where we never broke $10 million, but we were close. And by that time, I had bought huge tracts of commercial property, and I'd built more buildings and more stores and owned them, owned the real estate, and I never looked back. And I was on my knees in a little apartment that was like $250 a month, at a turning point in my life, and that I was either going to make this right and walk through the fear and make the self-sacrifice and do this, or I wasn't. The book says we stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. And I went down a road that changed my life. And I never thought that that would happen. I didn't think, you know, if I make this amends, maybe I'll own this business someday. And never occurred to me. Never occurred to me. I sold that business. It's been, I guess, 10 years now. And I've had such an amazing life. When I sold it, I realized I don't have to worry about money ever again. And I thought to myself, how do I want to spend the best years of my life ahead? And I thought, oh my God, God's given me everything my heart desires, because all I've ever wanted to do was help people. And I thought to myself, from now on, I'm not going to do anything unless it lights me up. And my spirit is going to be the guide of I'm only going to do things that make my spirit feel good. And one of the great things I love to do is work with newcomers. And I get the time. And I come and share my experience on what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. There was a man 2,000 years ago who had died. And he died young, and he died prematurely. And it was sad. And his name was Lazarus. And a man came along and brought him back to life. And he was so astounded that he had another chance, and he was brought back to life. He said, what do I do? And he said, just go tell people what happened to you. And so we go in Alcoholics Anonymous, we go and we tell people what happened to us. We share our experience, our strength, and our hope. Sometimes it's useful. Sometimes it's not. But that's what we do here. We pay it forward. You can't pay it back, so you pay it forward. And I've walked a lot of guys through a lot of ninth step. I've gotten very good helping guys with their ninth step. There's always a way to make things right. You just may not see it. There's always a way. Fear and pride sometimes will block you from seeing what the course of action to take. You know what we are. I mean, we're those people that, when you're presented with some of this stuff, we go, yeah, well, that's all well and good, but oh my God, what about me? What about me? I mean, I need the money more than they do. What about me? And this is really a program of self-forgetting, self-abandonment and service. I'll tell you one or two little stories. I have guys often, I end up sponsoring a lot of guys that are in trouble, and they're sober a long time, over 20 years, and they're in trouble. And they've never really done all this stuff. And often guys will come to me and ask me to sponsor them that are in financial difficulty. And they don't understand why they're in financial difficulty, because they've had good jobs and they've made a lot of money. And it seems like the more money they make, the broker they get. And they come for me to me sometimes because I live this bigger than life kind of lifestyle. I have this huge house up on a hill that looks down over the city of Las Vegas, and I drive nice cars. I mean, I just had a 12-cylinder bi-turbo Mercedes. I turned it in for the 750 BMW. You know, and I fly all over the world. I do anything I want to do. So people come and they think, well, he's going to show me some tricks on how to become rich or something, right? It's not about that. It's not even close to being about that. In every single case of these guys that are sober 25 years, 20 years, that are in financial difficulties, we always without fail discover unmade amends. And they're either unmade because the people weren't chasing them and they think they got away with it. No, or maybe they've hurt some people financially and nobody knows it was them except one person. And it's the worst person that could ever know. It's the person that can sabotage your life. It's you. You know. That's the problem. The worst person that could ever know what you did knows what you did. There's a word that I didn't understand for years. It's the word's karma. I thought that the word karma was the way the universe would spank you for being bad. And it's not that at all. The literal translation of the word karma out of the Hindi into the English would translate as the word doing. In other words, you hurt some people over here and you never made it right, and now your life's turning to crap over here. It is your doing. But you don't know it, do you? You can't see it. I can't see how subtly the stuff inside of me changes my angle of approach to life in such a way that I become a bad luck magnet. Rather than when I'm spiritually fit, I become a good luck magnet. That it's all cause and effect. It's all cause and effect. And I get to work with these guys and I get to watch what happens when they roll up their sleeves and do the self-sacrifice and start paying back these people and facing. I've sat with guys. I have a grand sponsee that me and his sponsor, we sat out in their truck and waited, and he was sober a number of years, and he went and he had mugged a woman and messed her up pretty good. I mean, he didn't mess her up physically, but emotionally he messed her up and robbed her for $100 and some. And he had to go make it right. And it had been years. And people don't forget. And he went up and he knocked on, we're waiting in the truck. He goes up and knocks on the door and nobody answers. And we're watching, he's knocking and nobody's answering. He finally turns around, he starts walking down the steps, and there's a woman walking a dog who stops right at the end of the walk, and she's staring at him. And it's her. And she comes up to him and she says, "What do you want?" And now we can't hear the conversation, but all of a sudden she just backs up like this. He had told her who he was. And he's reaching out and he's got two $100 bills in his hand. And he says, "Please take this. This has been killing me, what I did to you." And you could watch as he talked to her, you could watch her whole, now, I don't hear the words, but I'm watching the physiological change. Her shoulders started to relax a little bit. And intermittently would get a little more guarded and then relax a little bit. And he told us later that she started crying and she had to tell him, "You don't know what you did to me. You ruined my life. I've been scared ever since. I'm afraid sometimes I put double locks on all the doors and windows." And he kept saying, "I'm so sorry I did that to you." And he got to make that right. And I've watched his life change around. Now he's got his own business and he's doing very well. He's made a lot of other amends. He's got a wife and kids, and his life has changed dramatically. None of this stuff's easy. On page 127 is a statement of cause and effect. In essence, I guess it could be one of the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's hundreds of them in this book. And this is really, not only has this been true for me, I have observed this is a truth and watched dozens and dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of people experience this. The very middle of the page, the fourth line down in the middle paragraph, although financial recovery is on the way for many of us, we found we could not place money first. For us, now check the cause and effect here. For us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress. It never preceded it. What does that mean? It means if you do all the right thing, make your amends, you're going to get rich? No. But it does promise what it says in step 9, that the fear of financial insecurity will leave you. I have a friend who makes several million dollars every year, and he has zero material well-being. I don't know anybody, I don't think I've ever known anybody that worries more about money and is more insecure and has more fear in that area. I know other people that have meager jobs as like school teachers, things that don't pay very much, And they have a tremendous sense of well-being because they are right with God. They know that God's got their back. They're right with the people in their life. And they have to worry about, they know they don't have to worry about anything. And they don't worry about anything. And they have material well-being. They don't anguish over money. And they don't make very much at all. And then there's people who make tons of money and anguish over every dime. See, there's a delusion that it talked about, this delusion that we can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if we only manage well. And I think that often exemplifies itself in this headset that if I get the outsides good enough that I'll feel good. But some of us know very painfully that no matter how good you get it out here, if it ain't no good in here, it ain't no good. That's why alcoholics will drink themselves to death or commit suicide in $5 million homes. You would think that abundance, if you put the abundance first and you could, the illusion is that you can fill up the empty spaces in your life with acquisition of stuff. But it doesn't. It actually does a hideous thing that's the reverse. Because if nothing changes on the inside and you've willfully, forcefully created this tremendous, materially abundant life, the fantasy is that the abundance will make the vacancy seem smaller when in actuality, against the backdrop of what should be a tremendously amazing life, the backdrop of the abundance makes the vacancy stand out in harsher and more stark relief. Because now what? You know, it's odd. I was talking with some friends of mine in Vegas not too long ago. We were talking about all the people we've seen commit suicide over the years, and some of the people that would drank themselves to death, and it started after 20 years of sobriety. And when their demise started at a moment when materially they had almost everything that they would have put on a checklist when they first got sober. They had it all. Well, my friend Frank, at 23 and a half years sober, put the plastic bag over his head, took the handful of pills and put the plastic bag with a rubber band and took his own life. I mean, he had everything. He was married to this gal, Whitney, who was a model. She was gorgeous. She adored him. He had this huge house. He'd become the top painting contractor in the whole city of Las Vegas, and he had contracts for all kinds of everything from hotels to, I mean, he was making probably $500,000 or more a year. He had one of the most beautiful custom candy apple red Harleys I've ever seen. He had the first year Corvette completely restored. It was beautiful. Had a custom truck. He had everything out here. On the day he pulled the plug, He had, and I knew him when he got sober. He got sober. Everything he owned was, he came out of prison. Everything he owned was in a paper sack. It was an extra pair of socks and an extra pair of underwear. If he would have sat down on the day he came to Alcoholics Anonymous and made a checklist of everything he'd like to see happen in his life over the next 20 years, when he pulled the plug, he'd fulfilled the checklist. But he'd put money first. He put the material before the spiritual. And that's what that's like. It's like deciding to build a 30-story office building and you're making the ground floor and the foundation out of plywood. It will never, the first windstorm in the building crumbles. We lay a foundation here on spiritual actions that sustain us the rest of our lives. So when it says, for us, material well-being always followed spiritual progress, it never precedes it. You can't put the material first. But everyone I've ever known that puts the spiritual first and helping others first and the amends first, I don't know anybody that's bought this way of life 100% and lives it, lives this altruistic lifestyle that needs or seems to want for anything. Some doesn't, and that's true of people in all different stratas of financial success. It doesn't, because it's not contingent on money. It's contingent on the inside stuff. And all of them have one thing in common. They know that life is on their side. They know that God's taking care of them. And so consequently, the hook has been removed from the money. It's nice, but it's not medicine anymore. When the hook's still in place, money looks like medicine. Money looks like a fix, and it's not. Ain't nothing wrong with it. I'll tell you, there's an old comedian used to say, well, you can be happy with money, you can be happy without money. I'll take the with. But the truth is, it doesn't really matter. I went through some big financial reversals in some of the investments I made because of the U.S. economy. And I never threw any of it. There was one point it went down so low I'd lost about $20,000 a month in income. I mean, it was a very significant drop. I never missed a meal. I still was able to do pretty much anything I wanted to do. I never worried about it. I was living at one point there just paying my bills, but everything got paid. Everything got taken care of. And I knew that it was fine, and God wants me to, whatever level God wants me to be at, hey, I'm good. I'm good. I know you're going to take care of me. I don't have to worry about nothing. What a freedom that is, to trust God enough to know that. You know? The desperateness inside of me is gone. There would have been a time when if I would have lost anything materially, I would have been in anxiety for weeks over it. Not be able to sleep. I didn't miss one night's sleep. Not one. Let's take a break. For lunch.